Okay, let me introduce this final talk. I will speak mainly in English. I think you will run the lecture in English, right?
Yes, my
okay.
Italian.
Yeah, so you will speak a little bit slow, okay. And from time to time I will translate just a little bit.
Okay.
Although they are pretty much acknowledged about the English, but you know, from time to time I will do a little synopsis. That is a good technique. Okay, so a very brief introduction of both parts. This is a class of the fifth year we call Laboratorio di Sintesi. It's a design studio, and I already introduced the collaborators and assistants. Generally, as a tradition for us, they are PhD students. They do their job as part of the PhD scholarship, and they do that in general 3 years. So it's also a way that they get involved to teaching. This is the way that we do. And the students, they are only enrolled in a professional program, 5-year professional program in architecture, and this is their last studio lab. We will work in what we call Aniene rings. That is, we selected around 50 spots along the Aniene River, and all these spots are put in a map, and each spot is let's say the home of possible design actions within that spot. The student decided themselves a kind of a negotiation which spot they think it is more appropriate for developing their idea. They start to develop a program that seems consistent with that area. They find a possible, we call virtual client for that area, and they will develop a project. This is a technique that we do since 10 years more or less. And we've done five large urban projects within that system, and that is generally finished with a book and expo, things like that. And this is what we did in Macro the last time. But this is still running because the Aniene rims, of course, along this, we are always talked about empty areas, and there are empty areas, general brown areas, lost areas that they don't have any type of logical development. They are basically abandoned. And for us, the role of the infrastructure, in this case, the Aniene, many things that happen around this can be important. Aniene is the second river of Rome, basically. It's the affluent of the Tiber. We've done in the past of the Tiber. So more or less, this is what they do. They do it with a type of teaching that is very structured in a way. I shortly described. We work in cycle. In each cycle, there is a concept. There are instruments, and there is expected results, but of course the whole modules are interconnected from the beginning to end. More or less, this is the thing. Okay, instead, Professor Michael Young, I put the website, because I think which is very important to have, this is my style. I will tell you one point. I think it's completely unnecessary to tell the title of the person. I will try to interpret the idea. When I have I want that the people will try to understand for a little bit what are the ideas of the person and then the titles, and not vice versa. So what is immediately clear from the direct study of the work of Michael Young, that is a unified body of knowledge, I will define like that, that applied in different area of application, but is a clearly unified body of knowledge that explicits in different research aspects that are of course growing, that are of course teaching, there is of course writing of papers, and there is of course, and this is very important, practicing of architecture. And these things are interrelated and strongly interrelated. And if you see the website, that appears immediately strong. By the way, a small part of that, of my students do also information technology course. Within the other aspect, there is the creation of their own website. And this particular case is very interesting because the website is really a clear mirror of that strong concept. If you see the singular product in the different area, you are surely very heated, struck by the strength of the ideas and the strength of the project, the boldness, I would say, of the different proposals. Some of them are I consider really extremely full of meaning and full of strength. So that's why I wanted to share a more deep sharing of ideas in this occasion, because it's an occasion important for you, but also important for the assistants and even for both of us. It's a better way to go deeper in the mutual knowledge. Okay. On top of that, that is the substance and some ideas that are evident for me looking at this work, there are, of course, the titles and the careers. And the titles of the careers are, first of all, I think, let me tell if this is correct or not, but Michael Young is, in a way, one of the people that followed the main understanding of architecture that comes from Peter Eisenman, basically, that is the idea that that there is really an overlapping between research and design, and the two are always combined to each other. There is this very strong intellectual engagement into architecture, and design is part of that intellectual engagement. So the relationship with Peter Eisenman, it is evident, it is strong, it is also evident the difference after so many years, but I think the flow is important. I'm pretty sure that Michael spent time as co-teacher at Cooper Union with Peter, and probably with our Italian friend Guido. Guido, has been there for many years. And probably you spend also some design experience in the Eisenman Architects, or not? Or was more the teaching aspect?
Yeah, I didn't work in Peter's office, but I taught with him.
Okay, yes, I know that. In general, there are two separate flows. Okay, so that is one part. So Michael Young is a professor at Cooper Union. Cooper Union is a fantastic school because it is a school of the highest quality in the United States. But has a very particular structure. It's the school that was created by the syndicate in the 19th, to create the opportunity for everybody of quality to enter in a high quality school of art and architecture mainly. But also on the base of merit and scholarship. Used to be 100% like that. I don't know, it seems a little bit changed.
A little bit changed.
But historically it was like that. It was also the reason why some outside North American students in a certain percentage can apply. And so I met from time to time Italian students that have been accepted to Cooper Union. It's a very interesting environment. It is really an environment in which the art and the architecture are very strongly intertwined, because they are considered like that. Besides that, so Michael is a professor at this prestigious institution, American institution in New York. The second aspect is that Michael has a professional a professional office that is based in Brooklyn, New York, with a partner, and they have developed together research, because I noticed that also the research adopted time together, drawings, paper, and of course, construction. They have construction, which is also very important for an academic, some of construction, of course, is not that common, that all the academics can, is not that every academic can have a construction. He has a few, and particularly very, very beautiful project. The third thing, and then I'm closing the presentation, is that Michael is a Rome Prizer at the American Academy of Rome for 2019 and 2020. So we get knowing each other. Actually, we knew superficially each other in previous occasion in America, but we met again at the American Academy. The American Academy is an institution that allows artists, scholars, and architects, etc., to spend a long period in Rome. Can be 4 months, can be 8 months, and during that period develop the studies in a very interesting mutual cultural exchange, because the different disciplines can talk to each other. In terms of the architecture, to be a Rome Prizer is a title per se. You will be enough to know that it's a Rome Prizer, because in terms of the architecture, many of the major names in American architecture, a good part of the major names in American architecture, have been Rome Prizer. Just to remember Lucan, just to remember Robert Venturi, Michael Graves, and you name it. So, you belong to this circle, and at this point I will facciamo un applauso. Very welcome to our school.
Thank you, Anthony. That was a wonderful introduction. I'm going to steal that style of introduction from now on. I quite like it.
Thanks a lot. I've been working a lot on that. It did not just come like that.
No.
It started from a crisis, because it tends to have this introduction that this is done, this is done. Instead, it's just the idea.
Much more important. Mm. Yeah, thank you. And I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Can you hear me if I'm speaking loud enough there in the back? A little bit louder.
No, I'll put a little bit. Yeah, she's on. Okay. Yeah. We can have a better problem.
And also, my Italian is horrible, and vita spiace. I'm going to do the best I can to speak slowly, clearly, and succinctly in English. But if at any moment you have a question, you have a thought, or I'm unclear, feel free to speak up, or we can do the kind of back and forth translation. So I'm going to show four projects for my practice, Yamanayada. I have a partner, Putanayada, in New York. But I'm going to begin with a set of ideas of things that I've been working on for the last several years. And it's going to start in... in what is maybe potentially a kind of strange place, but sometimes you got to start in a strange place. So this is an Instagram post that was sent to me by a former employee of Young and Ayada named Moore Segal about 3 or 4 months ago. And it's from some company named Dada Daily. And what Dada Daily are in the business of doing is selling very strange objects. This is the one that's for sale, by the way, in this image. And it's this candle that's a hand, and you light the fingers, and the only finger that doesn't light is the middle finger, and then the fingers burn down, and you get the picture. So Dada Daily is selling this candle. Now, I'm not interested really in that candle. I am interested in the image that they've used to advertise their product. This still life here, this Dutch still life that they've jacked their candle, their hand candle into. The reason I'm interested in it is because about 8 or 9 years ago, we were interested in trying to turn grasshopper and rhino into a painting instrument to make mm-hmm. drawings that would begin to develop aesthetic ideas that were within the lines of the painterly as opposed to the linear. How to derive colors, how to get atmosphere, depth of field, things to move in and out and to vibrate. And so we did these experiments, these okay. drawing experiments with grasshopper and rhino.
I will just say short, just say one point. La prima immagine è soltanto un'immagine che un loro vecchio assistente gli ha mandato. La cosa importante è che lui era molto incuriosito, era dalla natura bizzarra di quell'immagine in cui c'era questa candela, se ho capito bene, no? Al centro. Era molto incuriosito da questa cosa. E l'ha presa e l'ha messa lì. Adesso ci comincia a spiegare perché è così interessata a quell'immagine, mostrando questi riferimenti che lui e il suo collega, Zamer, hanno fatto cominciando a usare Grasshopper, che alcuni di voi conoscono, è un visual scripting molto importante, ma non per fare normalmente quello che si fa, ma fare la pittura, provare a farlo lavorare in maniera, diciamo, verso la pittura.
There's a lot of nerdy things going on in these drawings. We can get right into the geometry. We were attempting also to understand the ways in which our software is operating. And these are all straight lines made out of tangents and normals to curvatures, which are then turned off. But outside of getting the technical expertise, we were interested in what were the aesthetic possibilities of these tools we're now all using every day. So furthering from that, we were taking these drawings and then mapping these drawings onto digital objects that we were designing as an experiment with ornament and decoration, and then 3D printing them, fabricating them to try to find ways in which the full color powder 3D print could begin to have the implication of materiality other than what it was made of. Mm-hmm. It could become real. It didn't look like a model anymore. It looked like it was made out of some matter or material. To further test this idea, we started to jack them into 17th century Dutch still lifes. And we did a whole series of experiments with these. And the Dutch still life, in and of itself, is a kind of fascinating thing to investigate in terms of the ways that it handles reflection, luminosity, viscosity, texture, the strange fact that almost all of them have an unpeeled lemon, no matter where you look at.
If you want to have also this little guy, if you want to pinpoint that.
Unpeeled lemon. Unpeeled lemon. It's like they all went to the still life shop to buy their things to paint. I say that as a joke, obviously. But so here's the image, right, that Dada Daily stuck their hand in. So they chose our image to put their thing into. And I was amazed that all of a sudden our thing that we had done years ago was now out in circulation in the world and treated as if it was a real painting, a real thing. And so I had to contact them. And so I wrote them, thanks for using our still life. Cool if I use it in my lectures. It makes the point even better than I can. Hi, which one? Right? They didn't know. They had no idea they had taken our image. That should be fine with the context, academic lectures. It's just great that you jack an image into the image that we jack an image into, double the data. And this was kind of fascinating to me in a number of ways. So their image to our image to the original image. And part of why I start here, and part of why I bring this up, is that I am fascinated by the ways in which images construct the appearance of reality. And there's this phrase that I say that follows me through, and it's a tricky one, so I'm going to try to unpack it a little bit. But that one of the things that we're responsible for as architects is for the aesthetics of the background of reality. That's a big responsibility. So what am I talking about? By background, I mean something similar to what Walter Benjamin would call architecture is the art form that is consumed habitually in a state of distraction. Now think about that for a second. First time I read that, that really pissed me off because I did not want to be involved for the rest of my life in something that was consumed habitually in a state of distraction. I wanted to do stuff that people paid attention to, that was in the foreground, that was not the background. But what Walter Benjamin is talking about is something very important. Architecture is usually ignored by most people.
Yes.
It's seen, but peripherally seen. It's the ways in which we assume the world to look. And that assumption tells us quite a bit about the ways in which we assume we should behave in the world. And so that responsibility for those kinds of appearances of the world is a huge political responsibility. Aesthetics becomes politics in the moment in which you ask that background to do something that we don't assume it to be, and then maybe the possibility opens up for us to be other than we assume ourselves to be. This is a really powerful state. Now, architecture does this, okay? And by reality, too, I'm not telling you I know more about reality than anybody else. I don't have any secret access to the real. It's much more along the lines of realism. Realism as an aesthetic movement, we'll talk about in just a little bit, has much more to do with the ways in which art forms have made what we assume to be real look other than we assume. It estranges reality. That's what realism actually does. But in large part, architecture has been responsible for this for millennia. But more and more so, the internet and our image deluge that we're consuming by devices that we carry on our bodies at all times that are giving us more images than any generation has ever seen prior to this, and the generation that will come after you will see more images than you. Reality is increasingly becoming complex, and it's interweaving with images and with digital technology and with digital dissemination and consumption. And we ignore it at our own peril. So, images have been with us in our discourse on architecture for as far back as we care to go. Here's two images, and it's important to note that the drawings and renderings of Mary Mahoney are a large part of why Frank Lloyd Wright became known in Europe through the Wasmuth portfolio. Mm-hmm. And the images and photographs of Ezra Stoller are a large part of the ways in which Mies van der Rohe was able to transform a European practice into an international corporate American practice by the presentation of that idea of Mies van der Rohe's architecture. And you should also think about both of these images because they're presenting a version of the way the world looks, but neither of them are real. You can never stand where that photograph is taken of the Seagram Building unless you're floating in space. And there is no perspectival diminution. This means you have to have a huge camera with a huge lens with a huge print of negatives in order to get that kind of image. So already we have questions about what is real and what is constructed with images. Mm-hmm. Now also, we're not disseminating our information as architects through portfolios or through magazines anymore. We're disseminating it through the internet. And we are now not only responsible for the things we build, the things we design, the way in which we represent them, but also for the identities that we are building for ourselves through things like social media feeds, websites, engagements with whole bodies of knowledge outside of what we usually hadn't done before in the past. Tied into this now is also this problem that makes people very worried. If this is the place in the locus where we begin to see and understand what the world looks like, is there an issue, or what issue would there be when the images of architecture as found online are indiscernible from the images of architectural rendering as found online? This becomes a question, and it makes us worried. It makes us anxious about the ways in which we can simulate realism to such a high degree that it begins to become almost not only confused, but impossible to discern what is the real photograph from the image photograph. And then there's many more interesting things. Like, do an image search for Malevich's white on white. Which one is the real one? Because the one thing you're not getting is white. You're getting peach and aqua and light blue and some greens and all these other tones. And which one here is the original? Walter Benjamin had this other argument that because of photography, the originality of a singular artwork was losing its aura. It was losing its importance, its meaning, because it was infinitely reproduced through photography. But the internet is slightly different, because the reason why these colors are there is somebody has taken a photograph of the painting, Their photograph is taken under certain lighting conditions. Their devices have certain resolutions and color filters. They then bring them home and put them into other software that has other resolution and other color filters, and then they put them back up online. So these are actually all originals. Each one is singular in its performance. It's almost as if we have auras without an original thing anywhere, each one particularly interesting in its own right. And I actually find this to be as interesting as the Mileyevich painting. There's something strange about images that we take, we think we own them, we send them out into the world, they get devoured in a certain way by everybody else, and then they're spit back at us, and they become new reels. And so speaking of new reels, we have issues like the way we develop identity online. So here's Katie Jones, a Russia and Eurasia fellow, and she has a LinkedIn profile and she has an identity. But the question that needs to be raised here, some of you know what I'm leading at, is that Katie Jones is not a real person. Katie Jones was generated through a generative adversarial network by random pixels being compared with real images and then sorted millions of times until we get the final image. If you look closely, it's a weird photo. It's not what you think it is. And there's all these traits, glitches, errors, seams that begin to be allowed to discern what is the problem about the construction of this image. But if we're in a world where algorithms can build realities without our involvement, then we have another set of questions about the ways in which the image builds the world. And increasingly, our worlds are mapped by devices, mapped by Google Alert, mapped by LiDAR scans, mapped by photogrammetry, mapped by devices which are creating a double that's now not only two-dimensional but three-dimensional points in space. And that mapping is strange in its own right. These are the data shadows that are from a LiDAR scan, an absence of where the LiDAR can't see. They are, in a way, a kind of poche, a kind of pocket, a hidden space that's developing because the scanning technology does not have access to the way in which we know the world to be in our perception. But we ourselves have things that we don't have access to. And so now we have an interesting double between what we perceive to be the world and what machines perceive to be the world. And those machines are perceiving the world and spitting images at us. But those images are only displayed for a certain moment, for a certain time, for a certain thing called human eyeballs. Really, it's just this. This is what the machines are producing, and they're exchanging this information in ways that we will never see. Many more images are being produced every second that are for machine-to-machine communication than any machine-to-human communication. And if this gets you a little creeped out, it kind of should, because a lot of this is tied into surveillance and facial recognition and police states and other kinds of problems within our contemporary world. Okay, so four ways that we can begin to think about and or deal with this situation through aesthetics, through art and architecture. And these are four kinds of headings that I'm going to speak about each one of them briefly before I talk about Yaman Ayada's work. And each of them, I think, has something interesting to offer us to think about maybe some of our own assumptions about what is real versus abstract, this idea of the parafictional or the critically plausible, or the merger between, or problems between reality and its representation, the montage, which is the ways in which many images, if not all images, are being made today, and then the question of resolution. So realism versus abstraction. These are usually pitted against each other. And if you wanted to say, all right, so what's realism and what's abstraction, you couldn't do better than to maybe say a painting by Gustave Courbet in the middle of the 19th century, which is the start of French realism and painting, and then a painting like Glass Square by Mileyevich at the start of the 20th century. Somebody says, what is abstraction? That's a high vote. Somebody says, what is realism? That's a high vote as well. But we can actually ask some different questions about these, because if this is the start of realism, this is a very strange realism. This is an odd painting. This painting, and we could talk about this painting for an hour if we want to, but maybe we won't today. Think about what's going on here. First of all, this painting is huge. It's well over the size that is acceptable for a genre painting of a burial in the provinces. This is at the scale that usually is devoted to a battle by Napoleon, a scene from the Bible, or Ovid's Metamorphosis. It's many meters long by something like 3 meters high. a huge painting. It's in the Orsay in Paris. Some other weird things. It's almost more like a flat bas-relief elevation. All the people flattened into the space and moving in a kind of very, very shallow thickness. There's very little foreground and very little background, except for the background of hills that are very far away. So it's like you've taken reality and squashed it into a vitrine that's a very, very small space. Then you look more closely at it again. There's a lot of weird stuff going on here. It feels non-compositional, almost haphazard. This is one of the ways in which it was called realism, because there's no pyramidal triangle or clear axes of symmetry. It's like thing after thing after thing after thing after thing after thing, like life. But if you go closer at that, the thing after thing after thing is kind of odd. I mean, there's rhythms here in the composition. There's this kind of up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, zigzagging rhythm that's moving with it. There's a larger kind of up, up, down, down, sort of sinusoidal movement. And then you get into strange things like the twins. These twin neckerchiefs, these twin guys, these twin gentlemen, twin choir boys, double twin pallbearers, and then this, which I've always thought maybe one person, like a conjoined head twin, kind of hanging right out there in the middle. And I don't know about you, but usually there's not that many twins in our normal environments. Twins in and of themselves begin to make strange effects upon our perception. Just watch The Shining or Dead Ringers, if you're into that. Other things. Nobody is looking at anything but somewhere else. And that happens on subways and trains, but besides subways and trains, usually paintings are structured so that you can follow where the narrative is by looking at what people are looking at. Here, it's all distraction. Pushing you this way, pushing you that way, pushing you this way, except for one guy, and that guy's here, and he's looking at you. So there's a high level of abstraction in this painting, and that abstraction is what produces the strangeness that becomes the affect of realism. It begins you to get you to doubt what you assume to be real, and that's what realism has always done. And now Malevich's black square, which is the desert of the senses, which is the absence of all iconography, nothing to look at, pure abstraction. But there's another way to think about this painting, especially now that we see it in its current state. This is maybe one of the first paintings that you would not look through. It's not a window, it's not a veil, it's not something that is presenting the world beyond. It's one of the first paintings that you look at. It's a thing. It's material. It actually makes you see its materiality. It's closer maybe to sculpture than painting. And in that, it's actually a kind of realism. It's a thing in the world. It decays. And when it decays, its decay becomes its aesthetic. When paintings from the Renaissance or Neoclassicism decay and crack, we don't see the cracks. At least we try to tell ourselves we don't see the cracks. When the black square decays, you see the cracks. It's actually what becomes part of the content of the painting. And so there's this strange tension between realism and abstraction. They're not counter to each other. In fact, they work in and out of each other continuously to produce their effects. Some contemporary artists doing similar things. This is Taube Auerbach. She's a painter and an artist in New York. These are a series of paintings she called folds. And you look at them initially, and they look like folded surfaces. They look like low relief. But they are flat, flat, flatter than flat. And so they're a kind of trompe-l'oeil. They're kind of a trick of the eye, but a trick of the eye that involves almost no skill, because the way she made them was she folded up the canvas and spray-painted it with dichroic paint and then ironed it back flat, which makes you, at the next level, begin to think you're almost looking at photographs of folded-up canvases, but no, you're actually just looking at folded-up canvases. So again, we're in this kind of loop, this questioning of what is real and what is abstraction. Because she's also playing very directly with themes of abstraction from mid-50s, Frank Stella's stripe paintings, if any of you know those. She's riffing on a great deal of the ways in which people took the flatness of the canvas and the bounding edge of the canvas and retreated it on its interior organization. And so she also is dealing with a kind of history of abstraction. Another artist. Let's let you watch it for a second. So there's a rock. And there's a mirror. Uh-oh. What's that? There's another rock. Wait a second. This one has, it's all silver. Wait, there's another mirror. Okay. All right, so you get the gist. Now, here's the question. Let's watch it. Which one of those is the real rock? They're both real. Which one was the first one made? Because I really don't know, because it could be the silver one, and then they painted the other one to look like a real rock, or it could be the other one is the real rock, and then they made it an exact copy in silver, and we don't know. And as you walk back and forth across this mirror, it's asking you to ask that question of where is resemblance and where is dissemblance? Where is art and where is life? Where do we leave that which is the simulation and enter the real, and where does the real begin to become tied up in the questioning of its own simulacra? Okay. Extending from that, we get a variety of art which is called parafictional. And I'll give you an example if you haven't run across that term before. If you're interested in parafiction, there's an essay written by Terry Lambert Betty, published in October magazine about 7 or 8 years ago, which is an awesome, amazing article. So this is a project by a Spanish artist named Joan Fontrevert. And what Joan did with this particular project is when, with the fall of the Soviet Union, they opened up a number of archives. And one of the archives he was interested in was the Soyuz 2 mission from the Russian cosmonauts. It was the second manned mission that the Soviets sent into space. And it was the only one of which there was no information available about, which led many people for years to speculate that something really bad happened. And they had to cover it up. So with the opening up of this, he found this astronaut, Ivan Ishnichkov, or I can't speak Russian, but to get the point. And he found all these photographs of him greeting children and getting ready for the blast and meeting the press. And then...
So this was after Gagarin.
This is after Gagarin.
So we're talking 60 years.
Yeah, exactly. Found the photographs where the original... Yeah, there's Ivan, and then the removal of Ivan. And he puts on this exhibition, and he has the space suit, he has all the documentation, he has all this stuff. But here's the gist. He's Ivan. Every single photograph is a self-portrait of Jean Fonculberta, jacked into other images that he found. And then this becomes really interesting, because that means that actually, this is the real image, this is the original image, and this is the fake one that he made look more real than the real one. But since you have these two together, there is no way now that you cannot look at this image, which is the real image, and not think, who's missing? It's not Jean-Fonculberta, Ivan Nishnikov, it's somebody, though, because there's something really weird about that spot and that image. And what parafiction gets you to do is it pushes pressure right on this line of when and where and how you discern what is real and what is fake. And it asks you to question that line. So it not only trains you in doubt, but it trains you in belief. And I can't imagine a more important time than now with all of the stuff that's going on with the ways in which politics is using media, to be able to delve deeply into a critical aesthetic practice that is asking those questions and trying to get us to think differently and more intensely, engage with the images that our worlds produce. Okay. The idea of montage. So, beginning with the Berlin Dada, and there's earlier roots if we try to trace them, but beginning with the Berlin Dada, montage becomes one of the forms in which image making is pushed forward to engage questions of politics within the 20th century. And the fact that you could take an image, appropriate it, decontextualize it, and then reinsert it into a new context with other images and change the meaning of the original image to get it to clash, to get it to shock, to get it to jar, to become more akin to the cities and metropolises of the early 20th century, which were scaring the living daylights out of people with new technology, new transportation, new intensities of occupation. Montage became a form in which the shock of the city could begin to become absorbed as an aesthetic by the people living in those cities. Montage also has become, in many different forms, one of the ways in which architecture began to engage image-making throughout the 20th century. And one of the things I want to bring up about it is that montage work is a dialectic in juxtaposition. So in the Hannah Hawk, you need to see the scenes. You need to reveal the artifice of construction. You need to know that this is being put together. It's almost like an ethic of tectonic truth, the revelation of construction. That carries into the use that architects bring to montage. And it's often between things like foreground, background, building site, entourage, the ways in which people and things are represented that are non-architecture. And architecture brings that sort of juxtaposition of the scene with it, so that a critical representation is pulled to you, broadcast to you as being critical, because it says, I am not real. I have artifice in me. And in one case, the Johnson Mark Lee, the building goes abstract, the people look more real, and then in the Super Studio collage, or montage, the background goes abstract, and the foreground begins to become real. Now, what I want us to think about with that is whether or not that form of montage will still work in today's world. This is an image by Philippe Scheer. Philippe Scheer has his own art practice now, and has so for a couple decades, but he got a start in the 90s working for Herzog Gemelin as their kind of rendering maestro. And he does these, and there's a lineage to Berndt Philipp Becker and the whole Dusseldorf School of Photography. But what I want to call out here is this looks like a real building. It looks like a real thing. It's a little abstract in its silhouette, a little flat in its presentation, a little bit like an architectural elevation, but it does look like a real building. It's a montage of about 17 images done in Photoshop. And Philip Scheer is interested in the ways in which digital technologies can lower the resolution to erase the sign of the seam of the material construct. But he's interested in keeping the seam conceptually in the ways in which the strange effects of the image come to you. So you see this first and you think of it as a thing in the world, photograph of a thing in the world. As you look at it more closely, some of its oddities arise. One of them being, look at this pattern here. So the weathering is identical, and I don't know about you, but most worlds weathering is a haphazard interaction of chemicals like the building's surface and water. It doesn't ever do things identically, doesn't ever repeat. Other things to look at. What's going on within the windows? Because if this is the world of the foreground, there's no happy cafe that's situated behind me, or if there is, if it's also situated with an industrial bridge, the windows are giving you something that is impossible to put together within the world that the other parts of the image are showing you. And then there's some other things in this to look at as well. Because this is just a stretched version of that. Right? This is just a stretched version of that. So these little ticks, these little signs that become read from afar as the traits of construction or prints on material or the kind of patina of time, reality, are all just copy-paste digital manipulations. So the scenes, the juxtapositions, the dialectic is still there, but it's given to you in a very different manner. One more image to think about in terms of montage. So here's Google Earth, and Google Earth is part of the way in which we all understand the world to look now. And I'll confess, I still get a huge thrill out of hiking in a city in Google Earth and watching the thing just go. Right? And you come back in, it's an incredible feeling. But this should also begin to look a little strange to you, too, because it's a mountain range, but it's a mountain range unlike any mountain range I've ever seen. So this is an image made by David Rue and Carol Klein. They're architects in LA, professors at SIARC. And what this image is it's a montage. It's a montage done through a convolutional neural network, which is taking the features of the Himalayas and the structure of downtown Los Angeles and fusing them together. And so it's a montage done at a level of resolution that we can no longer pull apart. It's beginning to build a very strange reel. Which brings us to this last point of resolution. This is an artwork done by the photographer Thomas Ruff. What Thomas Ruff was doing in this series called JPEG was he was taking JPEGs that he found on the internet and then blowing them up. So this is a JPEG of, you know, like a few kind of small kilobytes. and he's blowing it up to the size so that you see the pixels, and thus exposing the kind of artifice of the fact that every digital image is a montage of discrete color information that's only hue, saturation, and brightness put together, and then you see an iceberg. But there's some other funny things going on here, because this is the low-res version that I got of Thomas Ruff's photograph off the internet. This is the high-res version that Thomas Ruff sent me because I'm writing a paper on it. And if you look at the differences between the two, yeah, okay, more or less. But look at it close. Here's the low-res version. Here's the high-res version. And you begin to see that actually what Ruff is up to is a little bit more intense than just taking images off the internet and blowing them up. Because there's resolutions inside of resolutions. There's images inside of images. They become abstract color field studies, some of them going horizontal, vertical, some of them gridding. And what he's doing is he's showing you what a JPEG algorithm does. JPEG algorithm compresses information, which allows it to be sent through the internet with more efficiency and opened on devices around the world, thus lowering in getting more people access to it. But in that compression, it's making a new form of aesthetic as it manipulates the image gathered by our devices. We still call these things telephones. We know they're not telephones. And we call the thing on them cameras, and we know it's not a camera. It's a photon detector. It's just detecting energy. It's not taking pictures of anything. And yet, we treat them as pictures. So in Thomas Ruff, you get this exploration of the multiple interlocked layers of resolution that are constantly building up our images of the world. And this leads a little bit into something that I'm also currently working on here in Rome. And these are very early stages of this, but you know that, right? Piranesi's altar at Santa Maria del Priorato. And what I'm interested in is how do we deal with the resolutions of point clouds? We know what to do with lines. What do we do with 8 million points? Do you move a couple of them? It's not going to do much. So our thought process through thinking about our representations via the techniques need to also evolve to begin to deal with the things like the point cloud. Because now edge is no longer the sharp cut of a distinction between inside and outside as one would cut in a plan or a section. Edge begins to become a fray. You begin to have bounding contours which are less clear in their decisiveness of telling figure from ground, in moments where figure and ground fray in and out of each other because the pixels, the points that are the cloud that are gathering this description of the world, begin to give us another aesthetic relationship to the resolution of the real. Okay, so that's the introduction.
That's the beginning, you know.
Absolutely, a couple ideas. So, and how are we doing on time?
Yeah.
Well, I've got four projects to share with you. These projects, I don't want to be misinterpreted. The projects are not proof of theory. The projects have many of these ideas interwrapped and interwoven into them.
Uh-huh.
But I don't expect to say, this project proves my theory. It's all research, as Nino said. And some of the research happens through writing, and some of it happens through drawing, and some of it happens through making objects, and some of it happens through making buildings. But all of it is kind of intertwined with a series of questions. So I'm going to show four projects from Yamuna Yada from 2015 to 2037. And they're going to move through some different scales from a small object for an art gallery, to an installation, to buildings, and to building proposals. So, here. First project I'll show was for an exhibition during the Chicago Biennale a few years ago in 2015. And it was for a series of flower vases. Now, what's a flower vase do? And I'd say it does three things. Okay? One, it positions flowers into a certain scenic character. A flower vase for a single bud is very different than a flower vase for a huge constellation and arrangement of flowers. And it poses them, kind of like flowers sit like this, or flowers sit like that. Some are very formal, some are very informal, some are very casual, some are for the dining table, some are for the kitchen, right? You got it. The other thing is it has to suspend the life of the plant that you've assassinated. And once that plant is dead, it needs to hold water so that it can live a little bit longer for you to appreciate it. And then the third thing it does is it wants to disappear. It wants to be as subtly backgrounded as possible so that you really see the flowers. So we built these flower vases. And what the flower vases are, is they're actually four flower vases nestled together that when they get bundled up, can be tumbled into multiple positions to make the flower vase take on the aspects of different character. Some could be funny, some could be slouchy, some could be perky, some could be serious, some could be nonchalant. But we wanted the flower vase itself to have different characters as you tumbled it around. And then we built this in several different explorations of digital fabrication. There were small little bud vases that were 3D printed plastic. There was others that were done in 3D printed ceramics, which could then kind of cluster and huddle up and cuddle up together. And then there's these larger ones we did, which were a multi-material 3D print with a kind of intricate coral-like pattern that was embedded like a tattoo into the surface of the vase. Now, all of that was really just a ruse, a MacGuffin, a trick, in a way, because what we were really after were the flowers. Because we made a bunch of 3D printed flowers, too. And we wanted people to not look at the flowers first, but to look at the flower vases first, and then only upon closer inspection see, oh my God, what the hell is that? And realize that the flowers themselves are constructs. They're 3D printed as well. And they're hybrids between geological, biological, technological, and floral sources. And each of them has a different kind of character that they pose themselves within as they insert themselves into real flowers. And the moment of kind of, I don't know, the moment that I was happiest about at the exhibition opening was at some point this woman was looking at them and looking at them and looking at them, and then she went, she had to touch it. You know? This is like, that goes back a long way, that old, when does doubt require touch? And that was a moment like, oh man, something worked. We exhibited these in Chicago, and then we got asked to exhibit them a couple years ago in Paris. And when we took them to Paris, we made a set of images to go with them. And we viewed these images as like scientific zooms into the surfaces of the flowers. So as you zoomed in on a 3D model, and you all know this by now, you zoom in, and as you zoom in, it gets more and more clunky, chunky, funky, and sort of fragmented. Well, for each level of zoom, we would design new models for that level of zoom, so that as you went in further and further and further to the digital model, as presented through a series of images, we would remodel new things at different scales of resolution at that scale. It's akin, if you've ever seen to Charles and Rain's Powers of Ten. You've ever seen that movie, you kind of zoom out from the planet and then zoom back into the planet. And there's this amazing thing they did with it, because at each level there's something that looks real and there's something that looks really weird. And then you come into the next thing, and this is kind of like what the world does sometimes. The electron microscope gives us a world that looks even stranger than the world that we see with our eyes. And so what is it about multiple levels of disjunctive resolution that allows it to begin to be read as more than data and become believable or plausible or possible as something in the world? Okay. Next project. This was an installation for a group of architects who were invited to build something that had to do with the digital fabricated detail in the 21st century. And it was at the gallery in Sayak. And so they invited these 16 architects, and we're back there. All the big kids are in the front. This is Neil Denari and Frank Gehry and Tom Main and Greg Lynn, and we're back there. So our take on it was like this. What's the most boring common detail that every modern construction deals with in some level? And we decided we would look at the wall reveal. So the fry reglet gypsum board wall reveal. And that's the little thing that comes in that makes the gap between a baseboard and a wall, or a window frame and a wall. And it allows you to finish off the wall without having the piece of wood or trim put on top of it. Very popular with modern galleries and modern construction. It makes the wall abstract, kind of floats there with just a shadow line as if it's not built out of really anything. These details are weird in and of themselves. These are Friar Rigoletto's wall reveal details. And we decided that we would make our own. And so we 3D printed a whole bunch of weird Friar Rigoletto wall reveal details and decided we would jack them into the most normal construction we could possibly imagine. So it had to be kind of slightly warped 2x10 joists with joist hangers and 2x4 wall construction and half-inch gypsum board. And the half-inch gypsum board had to be cut on all four sides, but this gave us four internal corners where a ceiling would meet walls, which is one of the toughest corners to deal with to detail, that internal corner where the ceiling meets the wall. And it gave us four opportunities for four experiments to test the ways in which these details would work. So one of them tried to make it appear as if the corner went back into an infinite space, as if you could just pull it all the way back. Another one tried to take the wall and furl it up and funnel the vertical through. All of these questioning this intersection, the way that details conceal and reveal, to question the intersection of the materials that they're dealing with. Another one tried to put as much pressure on that point as possible, kind of flirting out. And then this last one, which ended up becoming our favorite, this one right here, which is a very, very simple, just little twist, but it made the wall look wrong. Made the wall look like it was lean. Made the wall look like something horribly awful was happening to it. But the walls are perfectly flat and perfectly vertical and perfectly straight. It's just their intersection has a detail that slightly twists, and that slight twist presents a perceptual effect in great excess of the detail itself. So what we got interested in was the fact that these other details, you ended up looking at them. Whereas with this last detail, you were no longer looking at the detail, you're looking at the world. And it somehow disturbed the ways in which the world around it began to appear. Two other shots of that. And also did really strange scale things to the light bulbs, where the light bulbs looked too big. Because you're somehow in this world between a model and between real construction, but everything is one-to-one full scale, so that's our problem, not its problem, is our perception of what is scale. And then we also made these images where we stole the most banal renderings we could from the internet and started jacking our details into them. And then sending them around to our friends to see what they would think. And most of them thought we were out of our mind, but it does do something where all of a sudden that banal world around you begins to become slightly other, slightly strange, and you begin to question it at a different way. How can the image of the world become the real world and as strange as that world to the other? So this project is a project for a 9-unit apartment building in Mexico City. These are the renderings of it. And it's an all in-situ concrete cast building with these windows that through ruled surfaces push themselves into the interior of the building. And we made this argument to the developer, because this is the first building that's kind of up on this hill that's getting redeveloped, and there's going to be other buildings that come next to it. And we said, well, basically, the problem is with a lot of apartment buildings is you build to the full lot line, you only have windows on the front and the back. And that's it. The sides have no apertures, no windows at all. But if you pull back a little bit, we'll have a different zoning code. We can go one floor higher, and we'll be able to have windows on all sides. But with windows on all sides, then you have the problem when your neighbor builds a building, you got a window looking right out of blank wall. So what if all the windows rotated into the building so you would have, no matter what, oblique views of the street and of the city down the hill, and there would always be light that would come in from oblique angles, there would always be ventilation that could be opened up, and you'd have this other possibility. So all our effort was into the windows, and into the windows and their fenestration and wall expression. The plans are very banal, and I'm going to show the plans. They're what you would imagine a developer building to maximize square footage and make them inhabitable. And so it's under construction, and it's almost done. And this is where it's at right now or as of a month or so ago. And we're just called Remains. We're building it, and Remains are doing it the way we designed it. There's lots of problems with it as well, but we're also just happy that it's kind of coming together. So the windows can be thought of in that pragmatic way to convince the client, which is a necessary thing, by the way. I don't want you to think I'm dismissing it. It was, without doing that, you will not get it built. But the windows were also another kind of architectural investigation. So there was two ways we were thinking about them simultaneously. One was as a continuous concrete surface that had been kind of dimpled, like a bas relief, like just kind of pushed in a little bit, and then the whole thing would have this sort of soft dimpling. And then the other was a tectonic expression where the lines of the floor plates would begin to get fatter and thinner, fatter and thinner and fatter and thinner, to question what is the thickness of slab. Most contemporary construction, when it does a window wall, goes slab to slab, and its ultimate tectonic is that expression, slab, 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 windows completely filling that space between them. So what if the window, when it turns in, starts to thicken the slab, and thus you get this sort of vibratory movement across its length? So because everything was on the windows, we had to figure out what the wind, how to do it, how to build it. And we went through a whole series of experiments and mock-ups. This was the first one, and it was pretty bad. We didn't like it really at all. We had the great fortune of a government change in Mexico, which put our project on hold. Usually that's a bad thing. For us, it was a good thing, because it meant that we had another year to basically experiment with mock-ups before the construction. And we started to get serious about the ways in which concrete had been handled within ruled surfaces, and started looking closely at Miguel Pisac in Spain, and especially Felix Candela in Mexico, and started studying the ways in which they handled the formwork for the ruled surfaces of these shell constructions, which are incredible things to kind of see and realize how thin they are and the spatial effects that they have. And so we developed a new system. And what this new system consisted of was, in a factory, building a whole series of wood formworks. Because we broke down the windows' heads and sills and realized that if you systematize them, you could have essentially six patterns that would repeat and be able to handle the entire building. Built these formworks, cast fiberglass against those formworks to then make molds that could then be used to imprint and cast against the heads and sills of these ruled surfaces of the windows coming together. This allowed us to also then do another series of mock-ups. It had a number of effects we got really interested in, like the kind of moment here where almost this sort of knife edge, where a little bit of light begins to creep around the thinness of the construction. Started testing also with the window assemblies. Much better, much smoother, much more in line with the idea of torquing the window into the building. But we also then also thought through the ways in which the board forming would articulate the rest of the wall, and realized that we could do something where the walls could be cast vertically and all the slabs and sills cast horizontally, and then started working with that as the system for construction. Here you can see these fiberglass molds on the sill and on the head. Here's the formwork for the vertical cast. Here's them moving from the first floor to the second floor, and the formwork itself is kind of intense and just crazy. They're like, you know, we did our best to control the details, but at a certain level it gets out of your hand, and the in-situ concrete casting construction teams in Mexico City are amazing. They do it all the time. They're really good, but they do it in a way that kind of flipped us out for our minds in the U.S. In terms of the informality of how the formwork was made. Here it is kind of coming out of that. It's kind of rough. It's before the windows are coming in. Here's looking up, and now you start to get some of that sense. Start to get some of that sense of the kind of softness, the kind of pushing and billowing, the bas relief of the windows pulling in and out of the project. And then here it is a little bit more recently cleaned up with the glass starting to come in. And I think you can start to see that sort of thickening and thinning of the floor slab and that kind of dimpling that I was talking about earlier with the desire for the ways in which the tectonic construction could reveal something else in excess of just its construction technology. I'll try to make this point as clear as I can. We sometimes get into the idea within architecture that the best expression is truth to materials, truth to structure, truth to construction, truth to program, truth to site, truth to whatever that may be. And if you are true, your building will have good aesthetics. That's not true.
That's not true at all.
It's not true at all. And so we fooled ourselves into somehow thinking this, but we know that actually when a building has aesthetic effects, it's always in excess because there's an idea driving the ways in which all of those things are manipulated to begin to produce that architecture. So we wanted
to... È chiaro questo punto lo tradurre? È abbastanza chiaro? No, perché questo è un punto fondamentale della questione, anche perché voi stessi venite dalla parte delle scienze formali, the Arduinian exercise from this, as I anticipated. Lui sta dicendo molto bene che uno è abituato a pensare che basta, come dire, una sorta di verità, no? Una verità costruttiva, una verità degli elementi, una verità delle cose, e questo automaticamente crea un'estetica. Invece sottolinea che questo non è vero per nulla, e il problema è come si manipolano questi elementi per ottenere un'idea, che è un'idea plastica, estetica, formale. Allora tutto questo problema di cui sta parlando, su cui già capite in realtà le parti precedenti della conferenza, un po' tutto questo gioco tra rappresentazione, trucco, doppie estetiche, eccetera, tutta la parte iniziale ovviamente va a confluire, no? Con una sorta di background su tutto questo ragionamento proprio architettonico. Appunto ha sottolineato assolutamente un punto che noi stessi stiamo cercando di ragionare. Cioè il problema è di avere delle idee che nascono attraverso delle categorie, e che queste idee che nascono attraverso delle categorie poi si esplicano attraverso delle scelte anche abbastanza particolari. Lui sta dicendo tutto questo mondo dell'infisso che a volte rivela, a volte non rivela gli spessori costruttivi, evoca più mondi, eccetera. I just wanted to say one thing so you can also take a little break before going to the end. I think I anticipated in the mail, but they are in the last cycle of what they are doing, and it is what we call the formal expression. And I developed a very specific teaching method about this. And I started to develop many years ago, and since it kind of worked, I applied and I fine-tuned. And he applied exactly what you're talking about. And the point is, basically my approach was based on their critical developing of only five categories of vision. So be sure that you have five categories of vision, and then you start thinking and manipulating that. So these five categories of vision are silhouette, chiaroscuro, attacco al cielo, so how the building touched the sky, how the building touched the ground, and rhythm. Now the issue is, and it applies so well to this point, that each one of these categories, of course, can be forced very much, or can be not forced at all, making out of zero, like you are in a, non siamo quella cosa del suono che uso, like you are in a mixer, like you are in a mixer. So silhouette is one mixer. You can force or you can put it down. Chiaroscuro, you can force or you can put it down, and attacco al sole, and we. So if we look this, you can look exactly how consistent is the whole idea, that in order to play everything on two major things that are chiaroscuro and rhythm, these are the two basic categories that he's interested in, for many reasons that we're not going to talk about, but basically, those are the two categories that are rhythm and chiaroscuro that he plays with. In order to do that, he has basically to flatten all the other categories. So basically, silhouette is almost zero, attacco al cielo is almost zero, except the technical thing that he has really has to have it. And also the attacco al solo is almost minimal. So within those choices, everything is concentrated in the rhythm. So that means how deep and what shape these guys have. And this other idea, that is the chiaroscuro, that means how you manipulate the different depths in order to make the chiaroscuro not something that comes mechanical out of a tectonic, but it comes as a very specific instrument of expression. So chiaroscuro is not mechanic at all, but it's very expressive. Mechanical, I mean, in terms of the tectonic. No? So this is the only way that I needed to translate what you said within the terminology, because basically this is what they are doing.
Yeah.
But of course, in other cases, it's a completely different project, because the silhouette is very expressive silhouette, and that particular in that case, you don't want to have a bigger chiaroscuro, because a very specific silhouette may contrast with that. So you have to, each one, try to find their own case, basically, you know, and what you have to work with. And so I think within Timito, it is kind of effective. And what we do in order to develop, basically they have as a base agreed or fixed point of the construction. So where are the slabs, where is how big it is, kind of fixed point. And then on top of that, with Miller, they go one of the other, and they start to think of the different categories. So that is the way that actually we do it.
That's great.
So in this particular case, there is no computer at all. It's done manually, in a long case.
That sounds
more or less what we do.
You're absolutely right. The idea of the rhythm in the chiaroscuro, and we often are thinking about it too as like a baroque, and baroque ultimately is a kind of rhythmic chiaroscuro expression. And in order to get it, we did have to kind of flatten out all the other expressions.
Yeah,
it's great. And the next project, by the way, we'll talk about the ground.
So there are five.
No, there's one more after this.
Yeah. I'm excited to have the fifth, because basically I was counting. I said, oh my God, this is the last time. Okay,
one more. So just a few more ideas related to this and related to the windows. We're also really interested in having the windows be clean, abstract, reflective surfaces that would change with the light, and the concrete being rough and raw and kind of brutal, and having that sort of juxtaposition be put into a kind of sharp tension. From the inside, there was this other question with the windows, and they were going to do something strange. We knew that. And we were looking at Robert Smithson's early sculptures of this in anthropomorphic chambers, and if you've ever seen these in reality, they're amazing. These two kind of awkward pieces of steel and mirror, but as you come closer and closer, it takes your eyeballs and it peels them back like this, and then infinitely repeats them in two directions. Very, very strange. So we knew that every space would have these two windows that would begin to split you, so that you would be looking both to the side and to the front at the same time. And as you came to the small windows, the operable windows, you would get the simultaneity of the reflection of the outside of the window from the inside that would begin to double the external reflection of the landscape from inside the window, because you were looking obliquely through each of these. We also started experimenting with the details, so that from inside you would not see the frame of a large trapezoidal glass. So there's a piece of glass here, believe me. But you cannot see it. It only looks like there's this optical window. There's a piece of glass here.
Oh my God.
But the detail is set in so that the chip board comes over it. So that you only see the operable window. And
it's kind of floating there.
You can see it more here. There's a piece of glass. Other weird things. Because of perspectival diminution with the trapezoidal window, from very specific spots in the room, it looks like the floor and the ceiling are sloping. I guarantee you the floor and the ceiling are not sloping. They're flat. But because our eyeballs... Andre Pozo, it's like the perspectival anamorphic projections that we see in Rome. But then, once you go to another spot, everything's fine. Mm. You're okay. Mm-hmm. Floor's flat. But our eyes do this. And then the moments where you're inside looking, outside looking, inside looking, outside. And so how to get not only that dynamic of the facade to have its effects from the external approach, but that it would charge the whole perimeter with a number of different possibilities for the ways in which you would use, inhabit, and experience the shell of the building in these different kinds of spots, so that it would kind of spark potential programmatic activity of difference, but we don't know what that will be. It's up to you to choose, but you would want to move around the outside because there'd be these constant sort of engagement with your relationship to the external world city. Okay, so this is the last project. So this was a competition, an open international competition in 2015 for a museum for the Bauhaus in Dessau, Germany to celebrate their 100th anniversary, which is 2019. This happened. So we knew right away that we didn't want to do this. And it's not because we didn't like this. This is great. The workshop building for the Dessau Bauhaus by Walter Gropius is an amazing piece of architecture. But we didn't want to do that for a number of reasons. One, this was the cutting edge 100 years ago. If the Bauhaus meant anything to us, we should not redo what was the cutting edge 100 years ago. Secondly, they've already got one. Why do you want another one? Thirdly, this was a school building, an educational building, a building built for pedagogy. This design that we were going to put forward was a museum. And it was a museum not just for the architecture of the Bauhaus, but for the workshops of the Bauhaus. And the workshops of the Bauhaus were weird. They did a lot of strange experiments with performance, with color, with textile glitching, with modern manufacturing, with the ways in which industrial machines and photography could be exploited for new means of expression. So there was a whole other world of Bauhaus that this museum is dedicated to, not just the architecture. And then the last thing was the site. It was a very odd site. So here's an aerial photo of Dessau. Over here, this is the Gropius building, right there. And the site for the competition was in a park, here in the center of the city of Dessau. So a site of a park is a very odd site. It's actually not bounded and controlled in the same ways that being given a normal urban site would be. It required a different kind of response. So what we proposed was this. And it's a whole number of clustered little vessels, objects, that kind of huddle together and sit like pavilions in a park, nestled, but each claiming to be an independent object in and of themselves. Each of them are actually versions of themselves, just rotated and then truncated at different angles. But when they all fused together, what they produced was a plan that was purely circles on a grid. So a plan that's about the simplest as you can possibly get. Circles on grid, but a formal expression of massing, which was a whole number of highly individual objects pushed and clustered together. And so in some of your things, one of the way it hits the sky and the way it hits the ground becomes crucial issues for us in this project. The introduction, this is a straight, you know, something goes back to Eisman, but the introduction of this Dehan here, that does that turn of the kickback that allows everything to become unified along a certain formal line, yet then begin to have independence between the two. So these would sit there in the park. There's a whole number of other moves with
lui parlava di questo dettaglio dell'attacco al cielo e dell'attacco al terra, e qui lui ha fatto questo tipo di trucco che è molto interessante. Lui citava delle esperienze fatte attraverso anche Hitler, ma comunque vedete che c'è questa linea comune, e quindi anche questo chiaro scuro sono come sospese, però una volta creata questa linea ci sono vari modi, no? Alcuni casi piene, alcuni casi qui, quindi c'è una linea, diciamo, di unità e poi una linea di variazioni. Non è come interessante questo, proprio questo tema dell'attacco a terra, che è fondamentale, perché come si chiedono queste cose? È proprio un problema, quindi è questa idea di variazione anche di continuità. Mentre, diciamo, come dire, da un certo punto di vista è più facile, è più scontato l'attacco al cielo, perché è chiaro, essendo ognuna istruita in maniera diversa, ha un mondo molto, molto differenziato, che però anche lui in questa fase ha voluto tenere una linea compatta all'interno delle quali avvengono le variazioni. Quindi in qualche maniera questo è il metodo concettualmente a quello di sopra. There is a common line in both.
Yeah, absolutely. So, from the outside, no apertures, except for one spot with an aperture where it's
very curved-like.
Yeah.
It's very curved-like.
Yeah.
Each one goes in one direction, the double, the green.
The building is clad in small glass tiles. And the goal with the expression was that from the outside they would be more muted, almost like kiln-fired ceramics. These objects, but you would walk into and under the legs, and in the courtyard, an entire different sort of aesthetic would emerge. And this was inspired by the textile patterns of Gunther Stoltz and Annie Albers, and the ways in which colors would glitch with the warp and weft of the textile manufacturing. And this interior courtyard would be much more kind of vibrant. The way that this was going to be manufactured is there's a robotic tile laying company in Massachusetts and in the United States where essentially, you produce images, and they have the robot goes and gets the tile and puts it down. It's usually done for really kind of kitsch crap things in Vegas, where you have an image of an island in the tile on the back of a casino. But they could do anything you needed them to do. So to dive a little bit more into the plan. So on the ground, you really only have the feet, the bottoms of the legs of these vessels touching down. Where they touch down, there's a kind of flower garden for each moment. It's situated diagonally to set up a diagonal to the corner of the city to cut you from the middle of the park to the corner underneath the building. And then you enter into it in this space. Oh, let me use this. You enter into it in this space right here, kind of passing under it for a moment and then into this entry bar. On the upper floor, it's all one level.
Mm-hmm.
Over here is the this is the permanent gallery. This is the temporary gallery up there. As the circles cluster together, they form this kind of intestinal rhythm. Like it's an enfilade, but it's an enfilade that's been warped into this circulation that moves you from single units, double units, to triple units, to quads. And I'll show you what that does in a moment. But the elevation, again, looking at that datum, the ways in which the building elevates, like Pilo T, but very unlike Pilo T, it's developed so that each of the individual objects has its own figuration, of which its relationship to the sky, the light nozzle, and its relationship to the ground as a kind of foot allows that sort of unification between top and bottom, while the datum line that cuts it, that produces that shadow, is what gives it that reestablishment of the ground in its elevation. So here you see in the section, you rise up through that stair, an image of that stair. The entry is much more an entry of verticality than horizontality. You rise up into a module. The only spot where the tile comes inside is in the cafe area, which is at the top of those stairs. There's only one column in the whole project, this one, and it's not a column. It's a rainwater leader because we couldn't figure out where the water would go at that one moment where all the circles, where all the butts come together. We couldn't figure out where the rainwater would go, so that's it. It had to happen. Here's a section through the main gallery floor. You start to see it's really one line across that datum with these different clusters above you, which speaks to its, which speaks to its construction, because actually the entire lower level is one concrete cast, and the pods are actually hats that kind of sit onto it. Hats that are made out of a timber lattice that can deal with the different geometries and deal with the different intersections. There's a skylight at the very top that bounces and diffuses light down. Here speaks a little bit more about the systems. All the systems are handled in the floor so that you're actually just heating the zones where the people are there to see the arch and not having to heat and cool the entire volume of it. And then the final thing that we were interested with this was the ways in which a bunch of individual objects, circles on a grid, clustered vessels, when they fused, would present surprising spatial moments as you moved along the internal circulation. So when they fused, you got very different kinds of spaces. It would be very different to be under one, under two, under three, under four. And that sort of conflict of what the tension between what you think you're going to get and then what you actually get when you're inside, that difference between inside and outside.
A kind of Boolean operation.
Boolean operation,
and each one decides what is positive and what is negative, so that the space...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Boolean operation, and it's also Saint-Evo. I mean, we were like greatly inspired by Borromini. Like, it's in that. Like, there's this sort of wave in which there's this tension between inside and outside. Clusters, huddles of objects, local relationships of symmetry of twins, one movement of a big symmetry, which is the moment of entry, circles on a grid, which fuse to become a series of unexpected spatial expansions or volumes of light kind of hovering above the space of display. So, 853 entries and we won.
Oh,
that's not bad.
Now
check it out. There was two winners. Here's the two winners.
Oh my God. Just there's two vincitori, I think.
Now the Bauhaus Museum in Dessau opened 4 months ago. There it is. It's interesting. They cut down 853 to a second round of 20. The 20 projects submitted again, and then they chose two winners. You should already know something's wrong when you hear there's two winners. Like I don't know, you've all watched the Olympics. They're not two winners for events. I think that we have a lot of suspicions about what happened or about why it happened. We think that there was an independent jury for the first two phases, and we think that that jury wanted our project, but that the Bauhaus did not, and their way around it was to say, okay, two winners, and then we'll have them do a third phase. And so we did do a third phase. It was great for us to do the third phase because we ended up having to get very real about the mechanical system, very real about the construction, very real about the pricing. It was a German-funded project that was ranked on 9 categories. And on 9 categories, we lost on 2. And this is why the other one was built and not ours. One category was maintenance. Their building was going to be cheaper to clean. And guess what? That's right. Their building would be cheaper to clean. I'm not going to argue with that at all. But if you're telling me you have an international design competition for the 100th anniversary of the Bauhaus to design a new museum in Dessau, Germany, and you're going to choose the one that's easiest to clean. That's not a competition I'm entering. And so it was very disheartening, to say the least. But sometimes the world goes that way, and we were pissed for a while, but we hopefully learned.
A little, how you say, after concert, a little bit on this project, or... Do you want me to shut up? Poi vorrei che gli assistenti preparassero almeno una domanda a ciascuno per dare un feedback, perché è anche bello quando qualcuno viene avere un feedback da parte di alcuni. Naturalmente chiunque di voi voglia fare una domanda, nello stile anglosassone le domande sono molto gradite.
So I didn't show this project today. I thought we didn't.
We have time. 10 minutes.
Okay, so this project was another competition. This one we got in. We did not win. The other one didn't get built, so that's all. But we did get into the second round, and this was for a concert center complex where they really wanted two performance spaces, kind of black box performance space and a more traditional sort of auditorium concert hall in Kaunas, Lithuania. So this is how we kind of structured out the site plan. And these two volumes here, so these two are the two main theaters. It's along a riverbank in Kaunas, and part of the way in which we were structuring and making this is that the building would be both simultaneously almost like the ruin of an industrial past and the projection of some kind of imagined future. Mm-hmm. And so the site is laid out of a series of linked gardens that we actually made a claim would be foundations for future buildings of another complex. And there would be two radically different characters. The character facing the road would be the character of the industrial that's down the site. And the character facing the river would be of a different nature. So I'll try to show some of these. So here's one of the back facades of the project, which you can see there's some similarities with the project in Mexico in terms of the ruled surfaces. But also this idea that there's two very different materialities. One is a kind of rough concrete, which is inscribed with a pattern. The other one is slate shingles. Mm-hmm. And where the two buildings touch or kiss is where these materials would shift from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm. And go up and down.
Mm-hmm. And kind of, so the roof would become the base, and the base would become the roof. And this is where you would enter, and you'd walk under this like an arch. So you'd walk between these two sort of massive, slightly scary buildings, and come under this arch.
Like the two stones of, was Vincent who was the guy, the artist that was playing with the two stones.
Alicia Kendrick. And as you cross underneath that, you'd have a radically different expression on the other side. So the other side then was as if you clip these with a laser, and that cut just fused into this highly reflective piece of glass. And at that moment, the bridge also became figurally or silhouette-like in terms of the ways it put almost a flat two-dimensional figure red against the materiality of this piece of architecture in the back.
In this case, you really want zero chiaroscuro, because it's really that idea of the cut, the cut.
And then this would turn into two different kinds of figures that began to relate to the buildings across the site. this one, which joins the two main theaters, and then this more independent figure on the side. The plans work in terms of here's the two separate theaters on an upper level, and there's that split. But the ways in which you come into the project, you come up these stairs under this one, and then there's a moment where they tie together, and you come up these stairs. There's that figure now as an internal with a spiral stair above you. This is looking back. The materials on the outside wrap and flip in reverse on the inside. This is the space of this internal bar looking out back across the river. Each of the theaters themselves are clad in photographs of curtains, not real curtains. Then the theater itself, as you look towards the performance space, is more closed in and abstract, and then you turn around to leave and it opens up. It's clad in curtains that are perforated with a marble pattern, not real marble. And actually, at a certain level, the model was our favorite. The model kind of told the story of the project in a way that the renderings didn't. This kind of tension or friction between two worlds.
Very good. So all these things are in the website, so you can study more. I think we have to thank you so much, Mario. Oh.
It's been a really fantastic lecture, complex, and I think that each of us is going to share following the lecture at different levels, because we understand the depth of thinking that is behind the action of this level in this lecture. And if there is a thing that you can, it always reveals this depth in reality, intellectual depth. In a way or the other, comes always appears. So in this clear case, it is clear. So the thing at the beginning are intertwined with this, etc. So that's why we have the audio of this, and some of us can go back, looking the images in the website, as I described, it's pretty rich of information. Allora, adesso vorrei fare una domanda, direi anche per Peter, prego. Se venite vicini, così magari viene meglio registrato sull'audio, però non viene sull'audio, se parlate da là.
I have some curiosities. First of all, it's really interesting the formal experimentation, because your project, the rest of your project has an original morphology. But I have some curiosity in the construction process on the project of the apartment in Mexico. It was,
I prefer, Michael, that you take notes and then you answer to all three together, because otherwise it takes too much time.
Okay. How many time you spend in the process of prototypation of the modes? And first, and second, how is the relationship with the man that built? Because you know you have a morphology that isn't a traditional morphology, okay? And third is, who is the client? And what is the relationship with the client?
Yeah, as a practicing architect, you can also be that. Important question.
Okay, thank you very much, first of all, for the lecture. It was really interesting, the process. I was thinking about the fact that your architectural buildings look like sculptures in the environment. And about what you said about the relationship between, the mutual relationship between reality or abstractism, my question was, what is the relationship between your buildings and the context, the environment? So, if there are there some inspirations from the environment that you abstract in order to arrive to this shape in the building? So, if there is a concept of abstraction of real shapes, like for example, in the last project about the museum and in the Bauhaus, maybe you felt inspired also by the very natural environment in order to reach this sculptural shape. So if you get a little bit in depth about this.
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, I was interested in the first thoughts about real abstraction, real, not real, let's say fake. I think in our case it's more interesting to talk about physical and digital. And so even in the theory and the practice, we saw quite clearly outworks in your case from digital to physical. You showed some example. I wanted to know if you have some experimentation of using digital fabrication at architectural scale. And then, if I understand good, about physical to digital, it's something that you're doing here in Rome as your research. So I would like to know more about this second aspect that maybe didn't show a lot in the presentation.
Okay, so it's not really a question, it's more like
a Prego, 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 cara. Venga, venga, venga. Fa molto piacere. Prego.
It's more like this amazing capability of shaping like the building. Does it refer only to the external mass? I mean, like the facade system, or it is also like related to like does it also have an impact to the internal space? So my really interest is, does it have an impact to the way of living the space?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She is a PhD. She is the first doctor for her home. Deve venire qua così viene registrata. You have to come here because then we will record. If you speak from there, he is another PhD of mine.
I want to know a question about the building of apartments. Specifically, because normally it is also a very difficult job to make architecture in a kind of building that is usually very conditioned by client demand. How is it is done the maintenance works? For example, how are those windows cleaned or from the outside part? Something that makes me attention is, do the bathrooms have windows? Or what is that dimension? Where is the stair, the lift? Because according to the north side, maybe it cannot be an internal stair, or maybe the lift is an internal, but according to the height of the building, does the stair have to be ventilated due to the height four or five floors? And that led me to the last question. Do you conceive or make this building from the design of the facade to the functionality? Or on the contrary, the first thing is to solve the functionality, the structure, the underground marking, many things that condition the design of this kind of building of this kind. And then it is decided the facade with that digital.
Very good that everybody is moved by their own interest.
That's
very important. If there is a question, there is always an interest. That's the trick. So, for example, this architect is a PhD that spent many years in design commercial residential building in Spain, and he decided to stop to engage our PhD to kind of have a long sabbatical of theory, uh-huh, etc. That's why he's making these very specific questions. So you will have 5 minutes to ask all that.
All right. So in inverse order, So there's let's find this one. What am I looking for? So there's the stair and there's the lift internal to the project. If that helps you out. And actually one of the things too is I don't know about Italy, but the United States would never let you do this guardrail in a million years. In Mexico City, oh yeah, we can do that guardrail. Yeah, why not? And we're like, really? Yeah. Oh man, we're so happy we get to do this guardrail. It's just brutal and cool. But
it is glass in the, or it's just angry, no glass. Okay.
No glass?
Yeah.
It's just, it was, and we're just, we're just.
Yeah,
we're,
I like that sort of thing. Keep glass, that sort of thing. Yeah.
To your point, not every bathroom has a window. A lot do. And so there was, you can't really see it here, there's like back there, there's a better image. But not every single one. So there was a balance between the internal functionality and the facade. And so the facade, the big windows that are the big trapezoidal ones, where are those? Here. Like these big trapezoidal ones always border onto the living spaces. So there's basically two typologies. The big trapezoidal ones, and then this little one that pulls the concrete in with it. All the little ones throughout the entire project are operable, so that you can open up the little one here and clean the big one.
Okay.
All the little ones are the ones that move into places like the bathrooms and the kitchens, and all the big ones are the ones that are out on the living spaces.
Okay.
As far as the construction, the client is, so the local architect for the project is a former student of my partner's, starting up his firm in Mexico City, and he got this job through a relative to propose for it, and he didn't feel like he was ready, and so he asked us to join him, and so he's been the architect. We live in New York. We can't be in Mexico City all the time. He's been the local architect throughout the project, and he's done a fabulous, fantastic job. So that's that question there. The project was supposed to be five stories. As you can notice, it's four in its final state. It's because when the Mexican government changed, they outlawed the zoning variance that we had applied under to get the fifth story. And that's what delayed the project for a year, and that's what let us have the extra time to do the second round of prototyping. Which made all the difference in the world. It's a much better building. I would have loved to have the fifth floor. I think it was a little bit better in its proportions, but hey, they got the windows right. They were able to find a way to do this construction, and we're happy about that. There's probably more in there too. Maybe related to that internal living effects of form. So the relationship between the external massing and the interior space. We're completely invested in the interior as well. Every single project we work on, we work from both inside and outside, and we're interested in the ways in which the tension between them can produce different effects. So for the Bauhaus, it was all about the fusion being an unexpected result of similar modules coming together in different ways. In the Mexico City project, the result of the windows produces, let's see, what's a good one to look at here? Maybe not that one. Easiest way to say it is, you know how a bay window to an apartment opens out and produces this little pocket that then is used for specific things? You can think about all of these as internally pushed bay windows, which means that every space that's in between a window becomes a kind of pocket. So what we were thinking about is the ways in which, on all the living spaces, the external envelope would become activated so that
depending upon where you put a chair or a table or different uses, there'd be these, no two apartments, even if they have the same floor plan, would be the same apartment, because it would force the inhabitant to find different ways to deal with that constantly changing envelope, because it offered different opportunities for being able to sit inside and be able to look obliquely down the street, be able to see the view in a different way. So we, you know, even the forms that are sometimes more exotic are conditioned by a desire for the inside. I don't know if I fully answered all you want from that, but there's other projects we could talk about too. The physical, digital, digital, physical. The question I would say with that, and there's a very long answer that can happen with it, but to put it into the short term, I'm of a generation, I'm 47, about to turn 47, is your question, sorry. So my undergraduate school was completely drawing by hand, completely traditional techniques. And my graduate school was completely digital. And I was taught by a number of people, Peter Eisman, Jesse Reiser, Nanako Momoto, Greg Lynn, with a number of people at that generation in the 90s into the early 2000s, which was experimenting with this.
What I call natural cat designers.
Exactly. And so we are of the generation that made that switch,
yeah.
And we're fascinated by it. But I'd also say we're fascinated by it not just from its potential to make new forms or new geometries or new fabrications. We're fascinated by the ways in which it's changing our relationship to reality. And so that's where this aesthetic, for us, the question is primarily initially aesthetics, and aesthetics driving different conceptual and political ideas, and not vice versa. And so most of the experiments we've done with digital fabrication have been at small scale, installations, artworks, pavilions. There is a level here even where there was a digital, to get the wood mold first, I didn't show it, but there was a piece that was basically CNC milled to get each of the kind of profiles that then allowed them to do the banding for the ruled surface, which then, so there is a digital aspect even in the fabrication here, but nothing on the building itself is a piece of printed or digitally manufactured objects. I'm incredibly interested in what happens to us with when we move into an aesthetics of the point cloud through photogrammetry and LiDAR. And that's what I'm trying to work on now here in Rome. And I don't have big answers or things to report other than suspicions about the ways in which...
There is the paper. Is the paper going to be published soon?
The paper should be published soon.
Okay.
And
you better go.
I'll let you know. I can send that to you, too, if you want to share it. It's been revised a little bit too,
okay.
To reflect
okay.
Our conversation.
Well, whenever you think it is, can be shared, it's really up to you. Probably it's better not waiting.
But what we're invested in there is how does something like scanning, working with point cloud, change concepts like poche,
yeah.
Change concepts like edge detail resolution.
Yeah.
If poche is the hidden space that exists within, between interior and exterior, the kind of shadow space, that now is a kind of absence of information or absence of data. And it's no longer just what's behind the scan, but it's also a question of resolution, of where resolution frays, and you have to deal with edge where there's no edge.
Very good.
Are we out of time?
Almost.
Almost, because there was two...
Yeah.
The question of context. Honestly, we think of ourselves as contextual architects. I know it doesn't look like it, but for us, the Bauhaus, it was about the context of the workshops and the context of the park. So given that internally we were trying to deal with the histories and forms and techniques and expressions of the Bauhaus workshops, and we were in a park, we actually viewed that as kind of a contextual relationship to it. The thing we often say is that what would be the ways in which an architecture could come into an environment and make you notice the context in a different manner.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of mimicking the context or trying to fit in effortlessly, as one, here's the slider again, So that's one view of contextualism. Then on the other side of it is drop the alien spaceship from planet Xenon that no one's ever seen. We don't want to do that either. What we're looking for is what is the insertion that doesn't claim to be to mimic its environment but makes you see its environment differently.
Yeah.
And that's our version of contextualism.
Very nice. Very nice.
And then the last question was about the client. I kind of answered that a little bit, and the mold and the construction. Look, the construction industry for in situ concrete in Mexico is there, like, let's say 80% of their construction is cast in place concrete. And so anybody there can do it. They just aren't used to doing it in this way. And if you zoom into this project, into this images, you'll find mistakes all over the place. There's some really rough moments. But they got two things right. They got it at the up close, the texture they got right. And from the further distance, they got the effects of the rhythm in the chiaroscuro right. But if you want me to point out all the flaws, I can point out flaws everywhere.
Molto bene. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Allora, noi ci vediamo al prossimo edizione del 53. Per quanto riguarda i ragazzi del corso CAD, arriviamo un po' dopo. Anche lì abbiamo...
Molto bene, fantastico. Arrivederci, grazie di essere venuto.